Open again your hymnal to that song we just sang, great hymn of faith, comes to us from another language. Note as the song appears in its title, there's a scripture that appears. Often songs, hymns, were born out of wombs of woe, and therefore they minister to those going through such. The Psalm 46, verse 10, reads in our Bibles, "Be still and know that I am God." In the ancient Hebrew, there is just simply one word, and it says, cease. Stop. One of the paraphrases says, get out of the traffic. It's the whole idea of resting, waiting, confident that God's going to work, even though right now you cannot see the end, and you may not even remember the beginning. You may not know this, but in the mid-50s, there were five missionaries who had on their hearts to reach the Aucas, an Indian tribe in Ecuador. They and their wives met together for their last meeting, and they sang this hymn, which gives a whole new appreciation for the words as you read it through, because you see those five missionaries never returned. They were all killed by the Aucas. And the good news is, ultimately, the tribe was evangelized. They turned to Christ. But at the time the missionaries attempted to reach them, the tribe thought, they're here to hurt us. And they speared them and they really slaughtered them. The five widows have found the meaning of this song altogether different now that they see it through those new eyes. Elizabeth Elliot returned, but before she did, she wrote a book called Through Gates of Splendor that you should read. It turned my whole life around. My whole ministry was redirected. In fact, the call to ministry is directly connected to that book. I've told Elizabeth that. And as I go through it again in the worn pages of my copy, I see the text of this hymn every time. Be still, my soul, when change and tears are past, all safe and blessed we shall be at last. Become a good student of the hymns. They're part of our root in great theology and the history of the church. Today we're starting a series I've titled The Grace Awakening. It's a series that has every possibility of changing your life. That is, if you want it to. Some don't, and maybe there's a reason they don't. So it might help if I gave you a brief picture of the current worldview of Christianity. You and I live in a world of no faces. That's right, no faces. And we're surrounded by Pharisees. I call them grace killers on the loose. Their desire in life is to help you be as miserable as they are. Oh, now, they don't think about it like that. They just spread germs of negativism and legalism. A lot of them carry Bibles and appear to be clean-living, nice-looking, law-abiding, church-going citizens. But they are killers. They kill freedom. They kill spontaneity and creativity. They kill joy as well as productivity. They kill with their words and their pens and their looks. They kill with their attitudes far more often than with their actions. The amazing thing is that they get away with it day in and day out without ever being confronted or exposed. Their intolerance is, for some reason, tolerated. Their judgmental spirits remain unjudged. Their bullying tactics continue unchecked. And their narrow-mindedness is either explained away or quickly defended with a shrug of the shoulders. The bondage that results would be criminal were it not so subtle and wrapped in such spiritual-sounding garb. This was also the world that Jesus stepped into when he left his home in heaven and came to this earth. However, none of that poison ever seeped into his life. In the words of the Apostle John, the darkness they represented could not extinguish the light that he personified. He was so full of truth and grace that he left no inner space for their legalistic poison. Instead, he offered to transform our lives and enlarge our entire concept of the Christian life, laying aside needless restraints and a super intense lifestyle to turn us into a more, well, winsome, affirming, understanding, forgiving, gracious, and I would even use the word magnetic people. Listen to this account as it is found in John chapter 1, verses 11 through 17. I'm reading from the New Living Translation. He came to his own people, and even they rejected him. But to all who believed him and accepted him, he gave the right to become children of God. They are reborn, not with a physical birth resulting from human passion or plan, but a birth that comes from God. So the Word became human and made his home among us. He was full of unfailing love and faithfulness. And we have seen his glory, the glory of the Father's one and only Son. John testified about him when he shouted to the crowds, "This is the one I was talking about when I said, 'Someone is coming after me who is far greater than I am, for he existed long before me.' From his abundance, we have all received one gracious blessing after another. For the law was given through Moses, but God's unfailing love and faithfulness came through Jesus Christ." And then a wonderful promise of freedom from John chapter 8, beginning at verse 30. John 8, verse 30 begins, "Then many who heard him say these things believed in him. Jesus said to the people who believed in him, 'You are truly my disciples, if you remain faithful to my teachings, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free.' 'But we are descendants of Abraham,' they said. 'We have never been slaves to anyone. What do you mean, you will be set free?' Jesus replied, 'I tell you the truth. Everyone who sins is a slave of sin. A slave is not a permanent member of the family, but a son is part of the family forever. So, if the Son sets you free, you are truly free.'" Time in prayer can be a time where your mind drifts, where you think on a number of other things, where you don't really focus on Him who is our sovereign Lord. Let's not do that today. Let's not drift. As we pray, let's think. Join with me, will you please? Help our souls to be still, our Father, in a world that's just full of noise and sounds of commerce, and the busy public driving and walking and running and moving, and in the midst of decisions, always something happening. Help our souls to cease striving, to find a restfulness that is only found in Him who came to bring us peace. Forgive us, our Father, for the wasted hours we have spent operating from the flesh, working things out, so that we would come out looking a little better or somehow impressing someone else. May we realize, our Father, that you're at work conforming us to the image of your Son. That seems to be, from our study of the Scriptures, your great goal. which includes grief and suffering, pain and pleasure, laughter and loss. The rearing of children and life after the rearing of children. Responsibilities at church and relaxation at play. You're at work. When things work out well, you are at work. When they do not, you are at work. You are our sovereign God. May our souls be still. May we cease and remember again that you are God. We're not even halfway to becoming anything like you. The distance grieves us, our Father, as we realize that our fellowship is often broken because we deliberately and willfully walk away from what we know to be right. Thank you for your grace that keeps bringing us back, putting us on our feet, never shaming us, always giving us hope and a reason to go on. May we become a people like your Son, our Father. May this church become a magnet that encourages others to begin and live a joyful, lifelong relationship with Christ. Start with me. Then move to this first row and second and third and then on up into the risers and on out into the overflow rooms. Do a great work, Lord. May it be a work of grace. Today, Lord, our lives are full of abundance. Compared to the whole other part of the world, we are all rich and enriched. Now, this is all from you, and we give you thanks. We do not revel in the pride of having earned it ourselves. Without you, we wouldn't be able to breathe. Our heart wouldn't beat. Those tiny little nerves wouldn't connect in our brains. We'd be at a loss to know how to live. So out of the abundance you've provided, we open our hands today and we give generously. And here's why, Lord. It's because we love Jesus. We truly love him. In his name we pray these things. Everyone said, this series of messages has the possibility of transforming your life. I didn't say it would transform your life. I said it has the possibility of doing that. Everything you understand depends on your response and mine. God doesn't do magic. Not even when his word is opened, magical things don't happen. Furthermore, there's no change brought about simply by hearing truth. It all hangs on your response, your willingness to change. It has the possibility of changing your attitude from, well, negative to positive, from closed to open, depending on your response. It has the possibility of improving your relationship with people. People close to you who live in your own apartment or home and family, people you've not yet met, people you work with, people you school with, people who live nearby, depending on your response, of course. It has the possibility of changing your whole feelings toward God, where he is no longer one to be afraid of, fearing that you'll be shamed by him or beaten up because you fail, living distant from him, depending on your response. It has the possibility of actually enlarging your entire concept of the Christian life, causing you to lay aside needless restraints and a super intense lifestyle, turning you into a more winsome, affirming, understanding, forgiving, gracious individual. That really is a possibility. depending on your response. Life is filled with people who are troubled. They're all over our neighborhoods. They're all around us at church. Some of them are created by their own wills. Some are the result of circumstances. Some choose not to live above their pressures and troubles. Dr. Carl Menninger has written a fine book called The Vital Balance. In it, he describes in one section those whom he refers to as troubled patients of his. Menninger, no doubt with tongue in cheek, mentions several things that characterize their lives. And I quote, "They have never made an unsound loan. They have never voted for a liberal cause or sponsored any extravagances." Why? He suggests it's because they cannot permit themselves the pleasure of giving. With that, he further describes them in these vivid terms. Again, I quote, "Rigid, chronically unhappy individuals, bitter, insecure, and often suicidal." You may be one of those people. If I read your face correctly, I think there's everything there that says, I'd love to be different. I'd love not to live the rest of my life the way I've lived it thus far. I'll go one step further. If you really capture the message of grace, you'll be free. You'll really be free. Free of what other people may say or think. Free of worry over the details and tiny little non-essentials of life. Free of opinions and strong words from those who have only your hurt at heart. You'll be free. But grace will have to get you there. There are many people who don't want you there. They want you as unhappy as they are. They want you to be enslaved as they have been enslaved and as they learned to be enslaved, because it is a learned trait. Every baby born is ready to be free. We learn not to be. People who live like that discover ultimately, if they ever do see the light, that their world is too narrow, that their expectations are too severe and extreme, their God is too small. Their faces are shouting, no, no. Every once in a while, I like to say to people that I meet who are pleasant and winsome and just full of joy, you've got a yes face. Usually those with them look at them like maybe they missed it, and they look at me, and then they look again, and there's this face that's saying, yes, yes, yes. That's not an original thought with me. I got it from a story I read about Thomas Jefferson when he was president, 1801 to 1809. He and some companions were traveling across the country on horseback. Can you imagine the president hopping on a horse and traveling across country with a bunch of buddies? Well, they get to a river that's swollen because of a downpour, and a stranger is there wondering how he's going to get across. One rider after another fords the river and gets to the other side. The stranger looks up and happens to see Jefferson and looks him in the eye and says, "Would you give me a ride across the river?" Thomas Jefferson says, "Sure, hop on." So he jumps on the back of this, behind the saddle, and they make their way across the strong current to the other side. As the stranger's sliding off the saddle, one of the companions said, "Why isn't you asked the president if he would give you a ride across the river?" He said, "The president, I didn't know he was the president. All I know is his face said yes, and all of your faces said no." Isn't that a great story? Some of your faces have said no for years. You just tragically don't know it. You just don't know it.
I think grace gives you a facelift. Not the kind that you pay money for. This one comes free. Not really free. It'll be the biggest changes of your life. It'll include that. It's hard work to fight for freedom. It's a difficult task to live in freedom, because you have to train yourself to think differently. Because most of us train ourselves to pay too much attention to other people, even though we'll never answer to them in eternity. Don't answer out loud, but let me ask you four questions. Were you reared by parents who had a no face? If that's true, you spent your childhood envying those whose parents' faces said yes. Second question, were you taught by teachers whose faces shouted no, no? Please don't answer out loud. Are you married to a no face? Quite probably, yours has become a no face. You see, this spreads. Fourth, do you work for a boss whose face shouts, no, no, no? Chances are good you've learned that look. I had fine parents, far from perfect. Many of the things they taught me were wonderful. Some of the things they taught me didn't help. I've had to unlearn them. I've had to break free of them. And so will you. Parents mean well, except for a very, very, very small percentage. Parents mean well, they just don't always do well. And so we pick up from them traditional habits, a look, a mentality, a way of thinking. You say, Chuck, it's really a matter of the heart. It's not a matter of the face. Well, some of you claim to have a great heart, but your face hasn't found out about it. That's the problem. And the only way the person who doesn't know Christ can read you is from your face. Do they see welcome? Or do they see stay away? Or clean up your act and I'll spend my time with you. Freedom gives people a yes face. I think it's one of the most attractive things of Jesus. I believe he transformed those 12 to begin with by winning them to himself. Why else would they leave their practice in the tax world or in the fishing business or some other world? And I wonder at times why he only chose 12. Maybe there were only 12 whose paths he came across who were willing to change. Because you see, in those days, religious cues were given by the intimidating Pharisees. They had the answers. They had lists longer than any list in the scriptures. To the Ten Commandments, they added more than 600. And they held their commands as equally inspired as God's commands. And their fingers were long as they bumped them against people's sternum. Get your life straightened out. Even though they themselves couldn't live the life, and so hypocritically, they covered up for it in their invulnerable manner. The freedom I'm going to be delivering in these messages is a freedom designed to help your face shout yes, because your heart will be relieved of many of the burdens you now live with, which trouble you. Now, before I go any further, a warning is in order. You and I live in a world of no faces. We are surrounded by Pharisees. There are people whose desire in life is to help you be as miserable as they are. And that is their pursuit. Oh, they don't think about it like that. They just spread the germs of negativism and legalism. I'm going to go a step further and say that the church is a training ground for terrorists. And the terrorists in training are in training to become grace killers. Much of the training happens at the church. It has gone on for centuries. That's why many, many people who think have formed the opinion that the church is not the place they want to be. They have enough guilt without being around people who intensify it. There's enough self-condemnation to keep you away from those who point fingers of condemnation toward you. These grace killers I described in a book I wrote. I never do this, but today I'm going to make an exception. There are killers on the loose today. The problem is that you cannot tell by looking. They don't wear little buttons that give away their identity, nor do they carry signs warning everyone to stay away. On the contrary, a lot of them are people who carry Bibles and appear to be clean living, nice looking, law abiding citizens. Most of them spend a lot of time in churches, some in places of religious leadership. Many are so respected in the community, their neighbors would never guess they're living next door to killers. They kill freedom, spontaneity, creativity. They kill joy as well as productivity. They kill with their words, with their pens, and with their looks. They kill with their attitudes far more often than their behavior. There's hardly a church or Christian organization or Christian school or missionary group or media ministry where such danger does not lurk. The amazing thing is that they get away with it, day in and day out, without being confronted or exposed. Strangely, the same ministries that would not tolerate heresy for 10 minutes will step aside and allow grace killers all the space they need to maneuver and manipulate others in the most insidious manner imaginable. Their intolerance is tolerated. Their judgmental spirits remain unjudged. Their bullying tactics continue unchecked. Very candidly, I will tell you one of the reasons I decided to start a church was to get it started on the solid footing of grace. It is so hard to locate a long-standing church that hasn't been eaten up by legalism, or scarred, or split, or broken. As long as I'm alive, and I have the feeling long after I'm gone, this will be a church of grace. You have a place here, regardless of your color, regardless of the mess you've made of your life, regardless of your list of failures, regardless of whether you look like little Lord Fauntleroy or you're covered with tattoos and piercings, regardless of the mess, this is your place. This isn't mine. This is ours. Let's not mess it up. Let's not become one another's judges. Let's be careful to address the logs in our own eye and leave the specks in other eyes for God to deal with. How's that for a deal? You say, sure. Well, it's tough to do. You know why? Because there's a little Pharisaism in all of us. I hear about the church that announced they had the most humble pastor in the world. And they fired him when he told somebody else what they had said. Humility is the most fragile flower that grows. As soon as you put it on display, it wilts. Genuine humility is a wonderful thing to be around, where nobody cares about who gets the credit. And everybody cares about who gets the glory. That's what made Jesus' ministry so winsome. He stepped on the scene and his presence sent shockwaves through the religious community. The sinners weren't turned off by him. Sinners never turned him off. It was the religious officials that hated him. Why? Because he called them what they were: legalists, whitewashed sepulchers, judges, hypocrites. When's the last time you called anybody a hypocrite? Don't talk to me about Jesus being meek and mild. Gracious, yes, but gutsy? Calling a spade, he had come from heaven. He knew what life was like. He created life. And he witnessed the mess people had made of it, who had walked around with their long robes and dangling tassels and prayers that called attention to themselves. And he told them off as he set others free. John writes of it in John chapter 1, verse 11, where we come to his words, and then later we'll see the actual words of Jesus and then the words of Paul. Just make note of deity who became humanity. John writes, he came unto his own. The Greek suggests his own things. The mountains that emerged as a result of his power. The lakes that filled the landscape as a result of his work. The universe he created with the stars all about. The galaxies that were there. He came unto his own things. And by the way, his own things followed him and believed in him and obeyed him. He said to the seas, be still. And they were still. He said to the wind, stop. And it stopped. Nature obeys the master, but not his own people. See the verse? He came to his own things, and those who were his own, referring to people, said, oh, wait a minute. Who do you think you are? You haven't been to one of our rabbinical schools. You don't wash as we have taught everybody to wash. You don't go through our rituals. You heal people on the Sabbath. And our rules say you don't do that. You see, they added 600 rules to Moses' 10. And they saw their 600 as inspired as Moses' 10. And because Jesus didn't, they called him a heretic. And they decided to kill him, which wasn't quite as easy as they thought it would be. Because people love to be free. And the more people's lives Jesus touched, the more began to follow him. Where has he been all my life? Where has that message been? Remember when you first heard the truth? Maybe today is the first time. And you're sitting there thinking, why haven't I been told this when I was younger? I thought that when I finally came across it. Well, I didn't understand grace all the way through Dallas Seminary. I didn't even see many yes faces among the faculty. They're good men, godly, gracious. They're just stern. And their faces said, stay away. And those who said, come in, I did. We became fast friends and we're still there. Their faces made an announcement, as yours do and as mine does. And as, more importantly, Jesus did. You imagine laying aside your nets. All you've known all your life is fishing. Along comes this man along the shoreline of the lake. He says to you, follow me. And you drop your nets, tie up the boats, and you start doing that. How about a tax career, making plenty of dough? And along comes Jesus with his revolutionary message that can then bring freedom and grace and liberty to your life. And you close the door, and you walk out, and you follow him. Imagine that. That's what it'll do to other people. But many of his own said, we don't have the time of day for this kind of message. Look closely at what John says. He was one of those who followed. Verse 14, the word became flesh. Deity became humanity. God became man. The word became flesh and did what? He dwelt among us. Imagine that. John ate with him, slept alongside him. John watched him. John studied him. John observed him in the morning early, and John watched him late at night when he was tired. He witnessed him. We saw him. We beheld his glory. It says, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father. And look at the first description of Jesus in John's gospel, full of grace and truth. What a contrast to the Pharisees, who stood on street corners offering up big, loud, eloquent public prayers to look pious. And along comes this man from Galilee who says, follow me. And John says, it was the grace and the truth that won us. In fact, it began to be absorbed and emulated. Verse 16, of his fullness we have all received, and grace stacked on top of grace on top of grace. We learned how to relate. We learned how to deal with life. We learned how to understand God. We learned how to walk with him. We learned how to laugh again. Oh, where are the artists who portray the disciples? Who are those guys that always paint them going, oh? Where is the laughter? Where is the fun? When are they swimming together in the Jordan? He didn't just baptize. When do they have fun together in the evening? It was grace, truth mixed that has no guilt, no shame, complete freedom. They could say whatever they wanted to say. And they knew he wouldn't condemn them. It was marvelous. What a balanced combination. What a magnificent model. He was like no one else who had taught us all our lives. No one drew us into his life like he did. He was full of grace and truth. Verse 16, it rubbed off. Of that fullness we have all received, says John, grace stacked upon grace, stacked upon grace, stacked upon grace, stacked upon grace. So that John's ministry, characteristically and not surprisingly, was a ministry of grace. To be sure, the law was given by Moses. Verse 17 tells us, you shall not, you shall not, you shall not, you shall not. 10 times. Nothing wrong with that. The law serves its purpose, making me aware I'm a sinner. At that point, it loses its power over me. Listen to me. The law does not dominate your life now that you are in Christ. The law had a purpose of bringing you. It was a school teacher to bring you to the classroom of salvation. And you learned from the teacher, the master, Jesus. And you imbibed a message of truth and grace. The law served its purpose. We no longer live there. Oh, that the Orthodox Jewish friends of ours would know that. You go to Israel, you watch the Wailing Wall, and your heart is broken, broken in sincerity and diligence and into late at night, sometime through the night, praying and praying and praying, and sometime pounding their head against the wall, wanting to connect with this God. And Jesus has connected him to us by faith. Wailing? What's missing? By grace and truth, realized through Jesus Christ. The Messiah has come, and with his coming is a message that frees you, gives you hope, tells you it's okay. You'll make it. You're not there yet, but you're on your way. And that's why Jesus died, to help you become who he is. The life that he lived qualified him for the death that he died. And the death that he died qualifies us for the life he lived. But we can't do it without grace. Embracing it as well as demonstrating it. The law served its purpose. Grace and truth came through Christ. And John says, as a result, we were transformed. When the Spirit of God began to work in the hearts of the disciples, they turned the world upside down. Not only in the first century, but to this day, all who have the message of freedom and grace have a voice. And the public can hardly believe it, because we earn everything we get until we come to God. And then it's handed to us by his grace. I had dinner with my sister the other evening, a wonderful time with several of the women of faith group. We just laughed ourselves hoarse. Delightful time, wonderful meal, pleasant surroundings, lovely home. What would my sister have thought if when I finished, I said, "Now, sis, what do I owe you for this meal?" How insulting. You don't owe someone for a gracious act. The meal was an act of love provided for those that she loves. That's what happened at the cross. God's love feast was poured out before us as his son died for us. We couldn't earn our way to heaven. We couldn't ever be that good, that clean. So don't start trying. Quit giving up all your sins to get yourself clean enough to believe in Jesus. It's a waste. Come just like you are. It's called believing in him. Did you see it in verse 12? As many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, even to those who worked hard to be clean? No. Even to those who stopped sinning, stopped smoking, stopped drinking, stopped chewing, they stopped speeding, they stopped all those bad habits, and then they were in his... No, they couldn't. You can't stop that. That's why I still speed. Can't stop it. Now, chapter 8. Don't just know this. Unnecessary comment. Go to chapter 8. Chapter 8 is a story of the woman taken in adultery. It gets really good. Here's this woman who is pulled right from the bed and dragged here in front of Jesus, half-clothed, no doubt. And these people who are listening to Jesus teach are suddenly embarrassed for her, as the Pharisees say, this woman was taken from the very act of adultery. What do you have to say about it? Well, that's a dilemma. If he says, condemn her, stone her, then his message of forgiveness doesn't work. If he says, oh, really, she meant well, it's okay, no problem, then his message on the holiness of God is a fraud. What does he say? Oh, he says, you who are without sin, cast the first stone. Peter Marshall, in his great sermon on the woman taken in adultery, has a great line. He says, you could hear the stones as they began to hit the pavement. And all those hypocrites walked out. You know what I've always wondered? How'd they catch her in the very act? Forgive me, but I think it was one of them that set her up. Jesus saw through all of that. I'm not talking about some namby-pamby message. This is tough stuff. He's looking at Pharisees whom nobody corrected. And he put them in their place. So naturally, they swarmed him like flies on watermelon. They want to know all about this teacher from Nazareth who doesn't even know who his daddy is. Our father's Abraham. We know who our father is, implying you illegitimate. So in the midst of a discussion like that, look at verse 30. He spoke these things. Many came to believe in him. Jesus was saying to the Jews who had believed him, if you continue in my word, you are truly disciples of mine. Look at this. Not the words of the Pharisees, not the words of traditionalism, not the legalist message. If you study me, if you continue in my word, if you follow my teachings, you're my disciples. And what will happen? You'll know the truth. And what? You'll be freed. You'll be freed. How great is that message? You'll be free. Free to believe, free to accept, free to respond, free to teach, free to share the message, freed from guilt and shame and embarrassment and insecurity. You'll be freed. You'll be freed. It's like the message to the slave at the end of the Civil War. You're freed. And they couldn't believe it. And the white plantation owners wouldn't let them. You've been a slave all of my life, and you're going to die a slave. And these people who had been emancipated officially by the President of the United States still lived like slaves. And it still goes on in the Christian life. I find people all the time living bound up in legalism. Aye, you'll know the truth, and the truth will make you free. Jesus also said, verse 36, if the Son makes you free, you'll be free indeed. You'll really be free. If the Son makes you free, if he says free, nobody else's bondage ought to even get a wink from you. By the way, just in passing, can we take a quick glance at Galatians chapter 3 and 5? Just real quick. First, 2 Corinthians. I'm always afraid one of the kids cut it out of my Bible. Here it is. Chapter 3, here it is. Foolish Galatians, chapter 3, verse 1. One of the paraphrases says, you stupid Galatians, who got a hold of you and shot you a crooked stick? Who told you that you now live by the law, having believed by grace? Galatians, how did you let this happen? We founded the church on grace, and all of a sudden legalizers came in and told you what you must and must not do, what you will and will not do in order to be found acceptable by us, and you believed them. Who bewitched you? Before whose eyes Jesus Christ was publicly portrayed as crucified? Look at chapter 5, verse 1. Talk about something to fight for. It was for freedom Christ set us free. Therefore, look at this. It's a command. Keep standing firm. Where? In your freedom. And, it continues, do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery. That's why I write as I do. Legalists are allowed to strut their stuff and nobody stops them. At this church, we'll stop you. That won't be allowed. This is a place where there will be forgiveness and grace and love and mercy and understanding. Sure, there are responsibilities. Of course there are. We're not talking about that. I'm saying the attitude, a spirit about this place will be one of acceptance, understanding. And we will not put people under a yoke of slavery. You'll never get my list. I have one. It's my convictions. I don't feel comfortable doing the things that the Lord has somehow convinced me I shouldn't be doing. Not necessarily spelled out in the scriptures, but as a result of gleaning from the principles, I've come to certain things in my life I don't want to allow, and you'll never know what they are. And I don't care what you think about them. I don't answer to you. Nor will I have the audacity to think you got to live just like I live in order to be pleasing. Christ is our model. I'm not. Please, keep that in mind. It'll help you. Because when I blow it, and I will, you won't be disillusioned. See, I've done that. I've pedestalized pastors and teachers, thinking they live up here and I'm down here. And then they don't stay up there. And then I'm disillusioned. So I've learned we're all down here. And by his grace, we sometimes soar, and more often than not, we blow it. And we're free to come back and to be forgiven. Stand fast in it. This series will help you stand fast. By the way, don't expect everybody to like it. I met a wonderful lady at an airport a number of years ago. It was the Ontario Airport in California. She walked up to me and she said, do you write a particular book? I said, yep, I did. Oh, she says, can I tell you my story? I said, sure. She was from a legalistic background, raised a legalist. Her father and mother were legalists. They were in a denomination that was legal. And she married a legalist. So we got a whole crew of them coming together. And now they have kids. And their kids began to rebel. They rebelled against the rules and regulations and demands and the rigidity of their parents. Kids are pretty bright kids. They spot stuff like that. Now, kids need boundaries, but these people were doing more than giving boundaries. They're telling them what to wear, how to wear it, what to say, how to say it, where to go and when to do it, and on. These are growing kids, and the kid's sick of it. So she said, a friend of hers told her, have you read this book? It's a heretical book I wrote. And so she said, no, I haven't. She said, we're not allowed to read it in our denomination. And, some cases, that's a compliment, by the way. Just like being fired from some places. That's a good thing on your resume. She said, I read the book. And she said it just turned me around. I thought, I'm not going to live like this anymore. She was even borderline suicidal. That often comes with a rigidity like that. So her husband noticed changes, and he said, what's come over you? She said, I got to tell you, I read one of the books that we banned. And she said, here it is. Gave it to him. It's a true story. He was a pastor of a legalistic church. And he read it, never told a soul, of course not. They'd have fired him. And he said to her when it was over, I can't keep doing what I'm doing. We're losing our family. I'm losing you. We're losing touch. So he said, I'm going to announce that I'm embracing the message of grace. They fired him. Not only did they fire him as he met the cold stares of his congregation, they ostracized him. That whole group of people that had been friends were no longer their friends because these people were now embracing grace. She said to me with this wonderful smile, she's by the way finishing her master's to go into a particular ministry. That's why she was at the airport to take the flight there. She said, my husband has been involved now in another church. And she said, our kids are back. And she said, you just can't know the difference. She was radiant with a joy that was contagious, folks. Absolutely contagious. And I've never met her before, and I've never seen her since. What is this grace? What does it mean? And you know what I thought? I thought she stood firm and was not going to continue under a yoke of slavery. Isn't that courageous? Takes guts. Takes guts. Especially if most of your friends are squint-eyed. You know, watching. You have your quiet time every morning? Did you pray today? Did you witness to three people today? You know, the list. Do you drink wine at that meal? Oh, I better stop there, man. I'm getting the stairs already. I didn't see them all. You don't know whether I drink wine or not. Did you go to that movie? You let your kids go to the dance? You a Christian? And on, it gets far more bitter than that. Stand firm in the liberty. Or don't call yourself a Christian. Call yourself a legalist. Stand free. Live free. D. Martin Lloyd-Jones once said, if you preach grace and nobody takes it too far, you haven't preached enough grace. Martin Lloyd-Jones. That'll get your attention. I mean, he's tight as a rubber band. Here he is telling you, if some don't go too far, you haven't gone far enough. That's the risk we run when we preach grace. Some of you will go too far, and I'll regret it, you'll regret it, and God will have to bring you back. Verse 13 is also in the book. You were called to freedom, brethren. Look at 5:13. Only do not turn your freedom into an opportunity for the flesh. So he warns against that. Romans says, shall we sin that grace may abound? Meganoita, God forbid, may it never happen. What a ghastly thought. He's not promoting that. He's just saying it's going to happen. But that's not what grace is about. That's grace taken to license, and that's tragic. That's unfortunate. Some will do that. So when you preach grace, you live with that possibility. I'd rather have that than legalism. There'll be less of those who do that than fall into legalism. Because God is at work in our conscience. But I'm not looking in keyholes. And I'm not checking your car. I got too much time I got to spend keeping myself straight. Thank God. I about ruined my marriage. I certainly ruined a couple of ministries in the process of learning this. I've decided that's no way to live. Let me tell you what you can expect from this series, okay? Where am I here? There we are. Four expectations. Oh, I got to give you a definition. Doggone it, I forgot that. Let me go back here. Starting to believe my own stuff here. Getting so carried away with this. What is grace? It's what God does for us that we don't deserve and cannot ever earn and will never be able to repay. In the words of Benjamin Warfield, it's free sovereign favor to the ill-deserved. That's vertical grace. That's salvation grace. What is grace to others? It's freeing them up to live their lives. All that they are to be in Christ. Even if it differs greatly from your life. Even if the lifestyle differs from yours. Nobody died and left you in charge of them. Jesus died in freedom. He freed them. So when you demonstrate grace, you set people free. You relieve the shame. That's the message of grace. What can you expect? Number one, you can expect to gain a new respect for God's gifts. That's right, God's gifts. His gifts to you and his gifts to others. The gift of salvation, the gift of life, the gift of forgiveness, undeserved favor. Grace will teach you to appreciate just breath in your lungs, the gift of joy and laughter in the midst of tough times and happy times, the gift of being relieved of pressure, the gift of a relaxed mentality, the gift of security, the gift of friendship and beauty and the arts. Your world will open. Grace will open your world. Second, you can expect to spend less time and energy critical of others, especially their choices. The more you grow in grace, the more you will operate in the context of freedom, and the more you'll want others to be free. You really will. Third, you can expect to be more, let's say, mature in your judgment. You'll be discerning, but you'll not be condemning. Grace will open your eyes, first and mainly upon your own needy areas, which will keep you really humble, broken, teachable. Finally, you'll expect to take a giant leap toward maturity. You'll really start to grow up. You really begin to be a Christian adult. You really will. Reinhold Niebuhr once wrote, "You may be able to compel people to maintain certain minimum standards by stressing duty, but the highest moral and spiritual achievements depend not upon a push, but a pull. People must be charmed into righteousness." That'd be great. Charmed into righteousness. I love this story I found of Sir Edward Burne-Jones, prominent 19th century English artist. Went to tea at the home of his daughter, and she let the granddaughter sit with them at the table. Very special treat. While the granddaughter was at the table, she began to misbehave, and she kept misbehaving. And finally, the mother told her to stand in the corner, face the wall, and stand in the corner. Being a seasoned grandfather, Edward didn't interfere with the grandchild's training. However, the next morning, he showed up early at the front door with his palette and paints. He went over to the corner where the little girl had been made to stand, and there he painted several beautiful scenes, a tiny kitten chasing its tail, lambs frolicking in the fields, goldfish swimming, little bubbles coming up as they're smiling at each other. He decorated the walls on each side of the corner with colorful paintings for his granddaughter's delight. If she ever had to stand at that corner again, at least she'd have something beautiful and fun to look at, said this grandfather full of grace. Doesn't mean that people shouldn't be standing in the corner if they've done wrong and suffering the consequences. That's God's business. But how about helping them get out and get on? How about hope for tomorrow? It'll give you a yes face. It'll change your whole life. Let's bow together. You heard about vertical grace, and it's very possible you've never entered into it. You've come to the cross in your mind. That's the place to be. It's there. You believe in the Lord Jesus, and he'll make you one of his children. Right now. You don't have to clean up your life. You don't have to start being good. You don't have to come to church every Sunday. You don't have to plead and wail that God would hear you. You'll be his child. How wonderful is that? Sit very quietly following this prayer. Thank you, Father, for your magnificent word that lives and abides forever. Heaven and earth will pass away, but never your word. Thank you for your Son, Jesus, and for his finding us in the corner and painting our lives with color and beauty and hope and a reason to go on. Thank you for grace. Amazing grace.
The preceding message, Grace, It's Really Amazing, was copyrighted in 2005, 2013, and 2019, and the sound recording was copyrighted in 2019 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide. Duplication of copyrighted material for commercial use is strictly prohibited. In the preceding message, Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. is grateful to Stonebriar Community Church for permission to use their 2017 performance of Amazing Grace. Lyrics by John Newton, arrangement and orchestration by Paul Thompson, copyrighted in 2013 by Stonebriar Community Church. All rights are reserved worldwide.